Hello, I'm Lindy Johnson from Melodix Magazine, and today we're talking with world-renowned hip-hop and R&B super producer Tony Dofat, a.k.a. the godfather of the hip-hop remix, and one of the original hitmen from the 90s Bad Boy production crew working alongside Sean P. Diddy Combs. He's worked with multi-platinum and notable artists such as Queen Latifah, Will Smith, Black Bra, Method Man, Jodeci, Tina Turner, and the Notorious B.I.G. Tony is most widely known for his work on Mary J. Blige's hit song, What's the 411, and the ever-popular remix of that song, as well as for his Grammy nomination for his work with his longtime friend and collaborator, Heavy D, on the artist's first and only reggae album, Vibes. Tony is also a global DJ, sound engineer, and music professor who has written 4 books on music production and the business of music. And today, we're here taking a mini masterclass with Professor Dofat. Hey, what's up, Tony?
What's up?
I'd like to talk with you today about the history and future of hip-hop music production. But first, Take me back. I want to go back. I think I read somewhere that you learned to play an instrument.
So just to go all the way back to my early beginnings, I was introduced to music around 9 years old. Well, even before that, just as a consumer, listening to my mother play music and my older brother siblings play music. But I didn't really start playing music or learning how to read or write music professionally or on any type of level until I was around 9 years old, where at that time I joined the school band and I played the trumpet. So instantly I just picked up the trumpet and learned how to play, and it was almost like speaking a different language. It was natural, like reading music and writing music. Once my instructor told me one time, it stuck in my head and I just never forgot it. So it was very simple. It was almost like a language. And I didn't really understand, you know, that it was really music until I got older and other people couldn't do it.
So you came up at a time when early hip-hop music production actually used live studio bands?
Yeah. So the music production from my era, growing up listening to music, everything was live. Mm-hmm. Everything was acoustic. There was nothing... There were no drum machines. There were, you know, no computers. We didn't even have internet. So growing up was just all acoustic and analog music. And, at the most, they had maybe a 4-track in a recording studio. This was before I became a producer. This was when I was a consumer.
Right.
So they had probably a 4-track or an 8-track, and you would have to just get the performance right. That's why when you listen to a lot of older records, there are a lot of mistakes, and people don't really realize. And people are too perfectionist, or they try to be perfectionist today, but it's not really about being perfect, like what's perfect. So all those mistakes are the things that make the songs what they are.
Right.
And what made people like the songs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can't take those away. And that's one of the things that I really love about older music, is that, all right, you have a studio, you have a 4-track, you have one shot to get it right. So you record 8 minutes long, and you just got the groove going. And if you do one little thing that you don't like, you're not going to stop and record the whole thing over. So you're just going to record it and put it out. So that same thing I applied to my records when I first started making music. So when I listened to all the Mary records from early on, there were mistakes in every song. And even vocally, there were mistakes. And we just let it go out, and people liked it.
So how do you look at your background of learning to write and read music? Yeah. And nowadays, producers can just create music without it, with computers.
Yeah. Reading and writing music is definitely helpful because it helps you understand. It helps you speak the language because there is another language called music. And to speak to a fellow musician or someone else that's musically inclined, it's great to have that terminology and understand how to count measures and understand what an E or a C scale is. So that's very helpful, and it helped me a lot. I didn't really think that I would need it, but it really helped me. It helped me communicate, and now I'm teaching it to students, and teaching them the essentials and why is it important to really learn and understand that. Because there are certain, you don't have to become a educator or you don't have to get a master's in music in order to make records, no, but you have to learn the fundamentals and the entry level of music. So that's some of the things that I teach.
So if I walked into your classroom today, what would be one of the first things I would learn?
I teach students how I learned. I talk about music genre and what makes music genre different. So before you start making songs, you have to understand what genre you're working on and what genre you're trying to make a song in. And I tell them the differences of why this is called funk and why this is called disco, why this is jazz, so they can understand and distinguish the different genres first. So that will help eliminate the type of artist you want to be, whether you're a jazz artist, whether you're funk, or even if you don't have a genre, it's cool, but understand the differences. And then I explain how one thing led to another and how funk was the birth of hip hop, and then how my part of taking R&B and hip hop and turning that into a remix and something else. So I talked about all the genres up till today, and that's the first thing that I'll teach in the music fundamentals class. And then we talk about the timing of each genre. So I teach the entry level of music theory at that point of
so
timing.
You do teach theory.
Now, on very little.
Okay, because I know very little. Producers today don't know anything.
No. Very, very little theory, because theory, honestly, I don't want to say it, is boring. We know that. But, you know, I keep it where it's interesting, and I show songs that are relevant, and I show real songs that everyone listen to and point out different beats and rhythms and structure. I teach students the difference between a beat and a rhythm. A lot of people don't know what is the beat and what is a rhythm. You know, that's a beat, and the movement, the continuous motion in the back is the rhythm. So a lot of people will say, oh, I like that rhythm, or I like that beat, when they're actually talking about the other thing, the vice versa. So they don't really know the difference. So I make sure I distinguish the difference between beat and rhythm. I talk about genre. I talk about timing. Those are the essential things that a producer really need to understand. That will help that will help your career drastically.
What is the importance of samples in hip-hop production?
Samples in hip-hop are, I mean, a lot of people say, a lot of people used to get on us a lot about sampling in hip-hop, but you have to sample, to me, in order to really be considered hip-hop, because it's based on sampling. Hip-hop is based on the DJ playing records, pre-made records that someone else made. That's what hip-hop is. And when we played it, then it became hip-hop. But if we didn't play it, then it would just be funk.
Right.
So we play it, and we make it hip-hop, because we take the best parts of that song to make people act the fool. We take that and we loop it.
The break.
And that's what hip-hop, that's the break. And that's what hip-hop is. And once we play it, then it turns into hip-hop. So it's a genre that's driven by pre-made music.
So when you're sampling to remix a song like...
You Remind Me.
Yes, yeah. You Remind Me. What are you looking for? What are you pulling out? What sounds?
Well, this is exactly what I just did in my masterclass. We talked about this. Having the ear as a DJ to know exactly what makes people act a certain way is what you want. So why not make a full song like that little break? So now, these great musicians that did funk only had a little break that was maybe a minute and a half. But the creativity behind hip-hop, we turned that one little break into another full song. So, and I always tell people, and I use this as an argument, so they say hip-hop is not creative, and I'm like, yeah, hip-hop is creative because we're the ones to actually take the best parts of the song and turn it into another long song. So if they would have done that from the beginning, then they would be the geniuses. So they are a genius on some level, yeah, of course, but then we take it and we kind of break it down and rebuild it, and we take the best parts. So that's what we do with the remixes, and that's what we do with hip hop. We take the best parts of the song and recycle it and rebuild it into a new song. And how do we find the new songs? So that's a little secret that we used to do back in the 90s, or finding the right songs. It's not really hard to observe people. And it's always good when you play music to look at people's reactions, because you want that same reaction with your music.
Right.
And if I play a song from the 70s or 80s and people act crazy and love it and just get goosebumps, then if you're taking that song or elements from that song, they should get the minimum reaction should be the same thing that they felt. If not, then you're not doing a good job by using that song. So you want to see the crowd's reaction. You want to see what how they react to it. And you want to take that, and that reaction should be displayed when you reproduce that song again. And that's how you can determine which samples to use and which ones not to. And it's all based on the 2 and the 4 bar loop. So when you break any song down, not even just hip hop, but any song down is broken down to a 2 and a 4 bar loop. Once you have that 2 and 4 bar skeleton going on that's hot and everyone loves it, it's undeniable, that's pretty much all you have. The only thing you could do is mess your record up from that point on. Because if you just keep looping it back and playing it, everyone's still going to love it, right?
Right.
So the only thing you could do is mess it up by saying something that doesn't fit or adding elements that you don't need to add and overproducing. That's why the biggest records are the ones that are simplest, and the ones that contain the least amount of instrumentation.
So what kind of tools did you use back then?
Just one keyboard and one drum machine. You didn't need a lot. You know, besides, of course, the elaborate studios and all that, but the Korg M1 was a standard, the Triton was a standard, the Roland D550 or the D50 was pretty standard, and the Akai MPC-60 or the MPC-62, and then there's an MPC-3000 or the MPC-2000 and the MPC-2000XL. So I've owned all those machines, and the Emu SP-1200. So I've owned all of those machines. Right now, I just own 2 MPC-2000XLs.
That's all you use now?
Well, I don't use those, but I own them, and I use them if a client asks for that particular sound, because I still have most of my sound kits built on those already. So there was a session that I did on the last Ja Rule album with Seven, the producer, and they wanted me to produce a song. And I went to the studio with a laptop and stuff, and they're like, where's your gear at? And I'm like, it's right here. I said, this is what everyone's using, right? And they're like, no, we don't want that.
We want your sound.
And I went home and got my drum machine, came right back the same day, loaded it up, did a beat in 5 minutes, and that's the sound they wanted.
You mentioned having tools on your laptop. So when you're producing a track today, how has your sound changed?
Well, my ear is the same. So the thing about it is that I can use today's technology, but I won't let it hurt my sound. So it's hard when you're starting out today, because you have no knowledge of what happened prior. So you didn't really develop a sound yet. The sound that you develop is what's given to you. So my era, we had to make our sound. And that's one of the things that I did throughout this masterclass this summer. I was teaching students how to develop their own sound kits and not rely on downloaded sound kits and sharing sound kits, because that's what everyone does today. And your sound is your identity as a producer. So if you have the same sound kit as everyone in the room, then there's nothing different besides the pattern. So my sounds have been sculpted by myself. I did sample them from songs, but I sampled them and I EQ'd them and I processed them different before I put them in my machine. And as I output them, I process them again. So they sound totally different. You will never be able to get a sound that sounds like that. And that's my sound. And people offered money, a lot of money for those, and I didn't do it. No one does. From that era, because we know that that's our sound, and when they hire us, they want us for that sound.
Right.
So as opposed to hiring a producer that's out today, that just started today, instead of hiring a producer, they buy the sound kit and just do a beat similar to it, and that's why they have so many beats on the internet for 99 cents, because, I mean, it's the truth. You can cut it out. But that's what happened. So my thing is, I'm just trying to educate a lot of these new producers, because there are a lot of talented new producers out, but they can actually become way more talented and reach further than their expectations if they actually stopped being lazy and did a lot of work for themselves.
How do you feel production has changed from when you were doing it to what these guys are doing now?
I think music has been the same for the past 10 years. I don't think things changed. The only thing that changed are songs and the artist. But I think if a producer today played a track from 10 years ago, I think it would still sell. Everything evolves. Music, I think 10 years, 2009 to today, as far as the producer side, making tracks, I feel that The tracks are pretty similar. The sounds have been recycled from 10 years ago. So it's the only thing that changes or that will change is possibly a pattern. But the triplet hi-hats and everything like that has been going on for 6-7 years, even longer than that, actually. So the only thing that really changed, just from my observation, are the sonics of the track, which depends on the engineer and the mixer. So because same thing with music from the 90s, we didn't really use a lot of 808s and a lot of low frequencies like 50, 60 hertz and 40 hertz. So today, a lot of that is being used a lot more than it used to be and 10 years ago. So you take a track from there and mix it over again, then yeah, it will sound current. But the pattern is going to be the same. The sounds are still going to be the same. You know, the same 808 snares and the same claps. But they're using a different combination, and they use a different way, the way they're layered. But they're still in the songs and.
And it's the same style.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same. And I mean, and right now we can just, even if I had the time, or if I knew the question prior, I would have songs to compare.
Give me an example.
From 2009 and from 2019.
I didn't know I was going to ask this question. You let
me hear. But no, when you you can listen to it now when you can go home, because just from DJing, I even found out even more, because what I do is I analyze music from all eras, from before I started producing, while I produced, and after. Like my golden era in 2009, 2010. And I listen to the songs and the differences and what makes songs big and what makes songs great. And understanding like why my songs became hits and I didn't even know. So it's like, it's crazy when you make big records and you don't know that they're gonna be big or not. Like the Grammy nominations, I didn't know. I didn't know any of that stuff. You just do it. And what is the pattern of making those type of records? And then also talking to my colleagues and friends of what makes your record so big and what makes it so great. And just studying that stuff and just putting it all together, I kind of analyzed all of those things already, and the triplet rhyming and all of that stuff. And that's one of the things that I really had to do is, you know, in order to teach that stuff, I have to really...
You have to understand today's music as well.
I have to understand everything, because it's just like when you're teaching, the worst thing you can tell a student is you don't have an answer to a question. And in order and to stand in front of a class every semester to take on that job, you have to know your stuff. So that's one of the things that, you know, keeps me on my toes as well, is just making sure that I have to stay current. I have to know what's what.
I want you to solve a debate for me. Some people are saying something that makes no sense to me. MPC versus MIDI keyboard with drum pad.
Yeah. All right, so MIDI keyboard, now just to let you know difference, there are some differences because MIDI, there's latency. Latency is a delay. So it's very, very minimal, but there's latency. The feel of the pad is also different. And just having everything self-contained within the MPC is a lot easier. The structure of it is just easier. You click on a pad, you can tune it just a matter of seconds without going inside and relearning all of these different VSTs. You can just click on a pad and your sound is there, and you can edit it, truncate the beginning and the decay, which is the end of the sound. You can do that instantly. You can add filters and you can do a lot of different things, and you can just program your beat instantly right in the machine, as opposed to using the controller and your software. You know, essentially it does the same thing, and software does a lot of times make it easier, like with Ableton, it automatically cuts your loops and sounds automatically. But would you rather rely on a computer to do it, or would you want to do it by ear? And that's the difference, is because every producer has their own style of truncating sounds. And just to give an example, like when you listen to, when you break down, and these are producers that I've worked with in the studio, you break down like a Pharrell or a Timbaland, or even just Pharrell, for example, I've heard it sounds raw and I work with them. So the beginning of his attacks on his kick drums are very tight, mm-hmm. and they're kind of clipped into the kick. And that's why his kicks pound the way they do. And a lot of people don't know. So you would have to set parameters on Ableton or whatever loop or whatever program that's going to automatically truncate your sounds to make it happen like that, which is highly unlikely. So that's a computer doing it for you, as opposed to your ear. And that's one of the differences. And when you listen to the sound raw, it just sounds like it's a mistake because there's a little pop at the beginning. But that's what you want. And especially with 808s, you want a little pop at the beginning, which is the attack, which kind of resonates throughout the smaller speakers because it has a frequency higher than the decay part. So that's what you're looking for, you know? And if you rely on a computer to do it, you're not going to get it. Mm-hmm. So you have to do it yourself. So that's one little secret, and there are a lot more secrets.
One last question. I know that you're also a sound engineer.
Yeah.
How important do you think it is that a producer learn engineering?
Yeah. It's very beneficial for a producer to learn frequencies, learn dynamic processing, and learn everything about the tonality of a sound. Because it'll make your job a lot easier when you're sculpting and when you're creating sounds. So I learned out of curiosity, and I learned just working with some of the greatest engineers, but they couldn't give me the sound that I was still looking for. And these are top engineers and mixers. And I was still looking for a specific sound, so I had to learn the software from all the consoles. I had to learn all the frequencies. I had to learn every button on the console and everything in order to operate myself. And after I did that, then my songs and my production actually kind of sound better, and people hired me because I was...
You were a complete package.
Yeah, so they liked me to play keyboards, and they would like me to program, they liked me to produce, and then they liked how I mixed. So that was an advantage that I had over a lot of other producers, that I pretty much did everything. And there were some times where they just wanted to hire me as an engineer and a mixer. And I did on some occasions, but most of the time I didn't do it unless it was my record because I had certain technique and certain things that I would do to my records. But yeah, it's definitely beneficial for everyone to learn some music theory and to learn about sonics.
Thank you, Tony. It's been wonderful learning from you today.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it. All right. We'll be right back.